Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Our program tonight is Cannabis, Healing Our Kids, A New Paradigm for Recovery. Our panelists are Talia Michelle, Executive Director of MAMA, Mothers Advocating Medical Marijuana for Autism, and co-founder of The Thinking Moms, Felicia Carbajal, co-founder of the California Cannabis Advocates, educator, activist, and social entrepreneur, and Amanda Ryman, PhD, manager of the Marijuana Law and Policy of the Drug Policy Alliance and Drucker Fellow, National Institute of Health. Our moderator tonight is Christy Dames, who is chairman and co-founder of CEO and co-founder of Tech Talk Studio. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to our moderator tonight, and thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you very much, Kevin. We're very excited to be here tonight. We have three panelists who have very important information around this new paradigm for our children, from epilepsy to autism and beyond, cancers, all kinds of things that cannabis is being used to help them heal. And there's some amazing stories. These women are on the front lines of the issue in Washington, D.C., Texas, Southern California, all of California, and around the country. So what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to start with Talia, and each person's going to give about 4 to 5 minutes about what they're doing, the current state of where we are with where they're focused, and then we're going to go into a Q&A with me and them, and then also with you, and we'll be bringing the mics around for you when we move into the next Q&A. So with that, Talia, welcome. Glad you're here in from Austin, Texas, and love to hear about what you're doing.
Thank you, Christy. My name is Talia Michelle. I am the co-founder and executive director of Mothers Advocating Medical Marijuana for Autism. My co-founder, Amy Lou Faywell, and I met at a special needs moms group in a conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist Christian church called Austin Ridge Bible Church. We are both Republicans. I drive a minivan. I live in the burbs. My beautiful daughter, Trinity, is here tonight. She is turning 10 in April, and her twin brother, Lance, has autism. I don't know if I can impart upon any of you what it's like to have a child with severe autism. Lance is moderate to severe, and it is a struggle. And we have tried everything, diets and biomedical interventions. We've traveled around the country and seen doctors. We've done any number of things. If you've heard of it, we've done it. We've tried it, save from heavy-duty pharmaceuticals. That's one area I've stayed away from because of all the various side effects, and we don't know the long-term repercussions of some of these pharmaceutical drugs. And so I have prayerfully and carefully been cognizant about what we do and what we don't do with Lance. Amy, my co-founder, had started talking to me about medical cannabis, but somehow it was tied in with the epilepsy thing. We were hearing about cannabidiol and helping with kids with epilepsy, and that was all well and good, but it didn't really come into play for me as something that could help my child. I started a book and a blog called The Thinking Moms Revolution with some other autism moms, and that got me into advocacy work about autism. And then suddenly I started hearing from mothers in California and Colorado that the children who have both autism and epilepsy, because a third of kids with autism also have epilepsy or seizure disorders, that these kids were gaining. They were having gains in cognition, in eye contact. Children who had never spoken before were suddenly getting their first words. Children that had been banging their heads through windows or biting others, hitting others, putting people in hospitals, some of these adult children with autism. Kids who parents were considering institutionalizing. These kids were suddenly making progress. And for me, as an autism advocate, as a mother, to hear this kind of hope for children from a plant that no one's ever died from or a God-given, a God-grown plant, and then to learn about the endocannabinoid system, how we have this system in our bodies that produces cannabinoids, and this plant can supplement it. And suddenly, I had a newfound hope for my child. But I live in Texas, and Texas is rocky ground for growing cannabis or even awareness around the word. So Amy and I decided to start this group, and we decided to go ahead and put the target on our chest and call it what it is, Mothers Advocating Medical Marijuana for Autism. And we have spent a year. We've been together for a year now, officially. We've spent the year at the Texas State Capitol, knocking on doors, talking to legislators, sharing our stories about our children and our friends' children. I think it is criminal that mothers are being put in a position to commit felonies to help their children. I think it's criminal that the plant has been so stigmatized and that it isn't accessible to patients. Our work, we're making progress in Texas. We definitely are. We're very close to having autism added in as a list of qualifying conditions on a whole plant bill that I like to say is a snowball in El Paso because it has very little chance of survival in our House and Senate. But it's history. This is the first time we've had a whole plant bill introduced at the Texas State Legislature. And so that tells you things are changing. There is a CBD bill, a CBD-only bill for intractable epilepsy that's gaining some traction, and a lot of conservative Tea Partiers who have said never are starting to say, well, yeah, maybe. So this is progress. One of our challenges is that autism is not a qualifying condition in any state, not even in California, and we want to see that change. We don't think that that's right, that mothers have to use comorbid conditions to try to get access. Autism is as viable as, what's the word I'm looking for? It's as much a legitimate disorder as any of the other disorders that are listed as qualifying conditions in any of the states. So we want to see that change. So our work is, after this legislative session, there's much more to be done across the country.
Great. Thank you very much. Felicia Carbajal. I would love to talk for you to talk about what you're doing in Southern California, what you've been doing for a long time around all this. So tell us your role as an activist and social entrepreneur.
My journey starts in the marriage equality movement. So I started there and made the simple transition to cannabis at an event called Coming Out of the Green Closet, Medical Marijuana and the LGBT community. I figured it was the easiest way to get people, other members of my other community, as involved in realizing that this is just as important to us. And three amazing things have happened to me on my journey. The first was I got introduced to dosed cannabis medicine. And what that has done for me, just as a medical marijuana patient, is allowed me to actually get off of Valium and Xanax and any other kind of narcotic and pharmaceutical drug that my particular conditions have forced me into taking. And it also gave me an amazing opportunity when I met someone, they said, you're going to be my next community engagement coordinator. And I was like, huh? So what does that exactly involve? And what does that mean? And I got kind of thrust into the cannabis world. And my job was to empower individuals who are utilizing the medicine to really begin to not only develop their personal narrative, but to come out and to empower them with just the small things to be able to say, look, this is my medicine, this is how it impacts me, this is why it's important to me, this is why it should be important to you, the fundamentals that I had learned in other movements that I had been involved in. So the job of changing hearts and minds is one of my favorites. Just because I think that as an individual who's a member of so many different communities, that if we can get people to just understand, they have the tendency to listen. So when I got thrust in this job, the second amazing thing happened to me was they told me it's harvest time. And I was like, okay, so what does that mean for me? And they're like, you need to get your moms, because at the time I was working a lot with mothers who had special needs children, and figuring out creative ways to get these mothers access to medicine, because a lot of the mothers couldn't afford it. So these moms began to write me and respond to my simple ask, and my ask was really simple. It was like, moms, they're going to go get a lot of material. Can you please write and, you know, just tell us how this medicine is helping your child? And every single mother that I wrote to responded. And bear in mind, I was having a pity party for myself because I was getting ready to have a microdiscectomy the next week, and I was in so much pain. And these moms who I had talked to had shared with me their stories, not just a mom, there's a grandma too, and that grandma, she always touched my heart every time I talked to her. But these moms, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, every last one of them responded to my call. And one special mom even came forward and said, well, you know what, I've got a vineyard, and you know, we grow a couple of plants in between, you know, but we, you know, our son who has Dravet, we know we can afford it, but what can we do? And then it really dawned on me that, wow, these moms really want to take the torch and fight. So I got invited to an event that's an annual event called Autism One. And I got there about midnight into Chicago, and one of my other crazy moms thrust me into another crazy mom who absolutely changed my life. She told me that she was a conservative Christian Republican who was going to flip Texas. And my first question was, you're okay with gay people, right? you're not gonna throw me under the bus, right? And I just, after that moment and being in that space, not just with, obviously this is the mother, not just with Talia, but with all of the moms, I mean, for 5 days, these moms sat there so intensely just trying to gather as much information. And I believe it was the first year they had talked about cannabis at Autism mm-hmm. One. And the other thing I noticed was Hemp Meds was there, and that kind of just upset me. But I tried to keep that as closed as I could, just because it was not what I considered medicine. Simply put, it's not something that I considered medicine. And this mother here kind of left such an impact that when I got back to my job, my work husband, who's sitting right here, I started feeding him the Kool-Aid. I said, listen, it's super simple. If we educate people, if we empower them with basic tools to be able to say, look, this is my medicine, this is how it works, this is how we can create the change. He didn't believe me at first. I think he was a little apprehensive, and then I introduced him to another mom. And this particular mom kind of, I want to say he almost cried when he heard her story, and then it was like, mm-hmm. I'm in. And so in those moments, California Cannabis Advocates was born. And it was born out of a simple need to be able to provide more education, to be able to give us a place where people can understand. So currently, CCA, which we pride ourselves on being the next generation of cannabis social entrepreneurs, we have 3 projects currently underway. The first one is a simple one. It's called Building Bridges. As a member of many communities, as I've mentioned, we are starting some simple engagement, and I'm starting with communities that I'm members of. So being both a member of the LGBT and the Latino community, we are doing some outreach and some health education with them in Southern California. The other thing we just launched is to change the culture and atmosphere. So we're calling this SoCal Leading the Way. And we're hoping to be able to change the atmosphere that's represented in a lot of the festival types atmosphere that we've just created. As I don't know how many people have gone to certain festivals that we have, or varying cannabis things. We're just trying to change the culture in general, so we're actually going to do some voter engagement and get people that are in the community to think a little bit past themselves. And then the last one is giving millennials a voice. The one thing that I found in just asking people, young people at these events, is they're so afraid to tell me why they use their medicine, and the stigmatization that just, in general, they believed it. And when you really have conversations with a lot of these young individuals, they'll be able to tell you, my parents have had me on Adderall since I was this old, or I've been utilizing this pharmaceutical, and we're going to use this space to be able to empower and also allow these individuals to basically just learn their personal narrative so that they have just the talking points, simple talking points to be able to articulate that this is my medicine, this is why it's my medicine, and this is why it's important to me.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Amanda Ryman, you are on the front lines of policy. But you are an academic, you fellow, I mean, you, and you've been in this a while, and you just returned from Washington about 3 hours ago. So you are definitely on the front lines. So could you speak to us about what you're doing and where we are with policy and what's happening?
Sure. So, hi, everyone. My name is Amanda Ryman, and it is a unique honor for me to be here today. I did just come back from D.C. a few hours ago, where I was at the National Americans for Safe Access Conference, which is a national patient advocacy organization. And we were talking about a lot of these issues that we're going to be discussing today, so it's definitely fresh on my mind. You know, I entered this as a public health researcher. I got my PhD at Berkeley in social welfare, and I did my doctoral dissertation on how medical cannabis dispensaries operated as health service providers. Because what I was seeing was that a lot of what was going on in a dispensary wasn't just about getting cannabis. I mean, that was an important part, but the social support that patients were getting from each other and the access to services like massage and acupuncture and counseling for free that was happening at a dispensary really made it more like a public health service than just a purveyor of marijuana. And, you know, coming to the Bay Area from Chicago, where I'm originally from, you know, I was kind of smacked in the face with this whole medical marijuana thing that was happening in the early 2000s because I moved to Oakland. And we had Oaksterdam, and we had all of these dispensaries popping up. And so I felt that there was a real need to see what the public health implications were of these kind of services, you know, to see what patients were getting from this. And so that research eventually morphed into the area of cannabis as a substitute. And I think that that, you know, is definitely meaningful in what we're talking about today, because from talking to medical cannabis patients, what we're hearing is that it isn't just about the marijuana, it's about the cannabis instead of. And so when folks are saying, well, you know, I'm using cannabis, it's because they've tried something else and they didn't like the side effects or it wasn't effective. And so it's really an empowering thing to take your own medical treatment into your own hands and say, you know what, I'm going to seek out something that works for me. And I'm not just going to listen to what they throw at everybody else who has my condition. And I was really seeing a lot of that happen at the dispensary level. I then went on to work as director of research for Berkeley Patients Group, which is a very large dispensary in Berkeley that's been around for going on 15 years now. Unfortunately, we were shut down by the federal government for being 980 feet from a school. After staying in the, having been in the same space for 12 years. They did end up opening back up down the street, but around that time I went to work for an organization called the Drug Policy Alliance. We're a nonprofit. We're based in New York City, but we have offices in Washington, D.C., New Jersey, New York, Colorado, New Mexico, and two in California, actually three in California, because our Office of Legal Affairs is here as well. We've had an active role in a lot of the medical marijuana legislation that's happened around the country, but also in the adult use cannabis initiatives that are now happening in states like Colorado and Washington and Oregon and Alaska. When we look at medical marijuana progress in the United States, we have come a long way from 1996 when California became the first state. But, you know, it's interesting because as many issues as we have here in California, and we could probably all sit here for hours and talk about the issues with California's medical marijuana program, you can get marijuana for autism in California because it's an open-ended list of conditions. And that is a decision that's not made by the California legislature or by the California voters. That's a decision that exists between the patient and their physician. And I think that that's one of the most remarkable things about California's law, because we didn't have that. We may never know that cannabis is helpful for some of these conditions because the barriers to research on the federal level are so insurmountable that a lot of the times this data, this science, this evidence, it's bottom up. which is something that we're discouraged from doing in the scientific world. You know, we're taught that you start with something very controlled with only a few number of people, and you really control it, and that's your science. But with cannabis, it's thousands and thousands of people over decades and decades of use that are coming back and saying, this saved my life. And you can't ignore that. And so, you know, we get a lot of pushback about the idea that there aren't these randomized controlled clinical trials on cannabis for things like autism. And I say, who cares? Mm-hmm. Because what we do know is that cannabis is one of the safest substances that you can use as a therapeutic agent, and that there are people that are getting benefits from it. And let me tell you, they don't do that many tests on things like Zoloft before they put them out into the general population. So when we really look at it, FDA trials aside, cannabis is one of the most studied therapeutic compounds that exists in the world.
Amen.
And so I think it's important for us to remember that and not get so bogged down with this very limited definition of what makes a medicine in the United States.
Thank you.
I love her.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the kids. Let's talk about these kids. Some kids are having amazing responses. Your son is having a shift, you told me. There are other stories that you know about. Can we talk a little bit about what cannabis is doing for some of these children, and how is it making a change in for their lives and for the lives of their family and everybody that touches?
Right. So I'm with Amanda about the research thing, by the way. Aspirin never went through clinical trials. There are a number of drugs on the market that didn't have clinical trials. And like she said, a lot of things are getting pushed through without much research at all. That being said, Dr. Jeffrey Bradstreet did some interesting research on the endocannabinoid system and autism. And he's a doctor who has been working with autism for a long time and has an autistic child himself. And he believes at this point, he's come out and said that he believes autism actually could be a deficiency in the endocannabinoid system that causes immune dysfunction. A lot of the kids have immune issues and a host of number of other things, but I think it's interesting as a preliminary first step to look at. We're seeing kids, you know, it's one thing to say, well, oh, you know, you're in Colorado, you could get it for your kid for this condition or that condition or the other condition. I really think autism as a word is important because we're not just talking about, oh, they got it for the gastrointestinal thing and you got it for that symptom. Well, yeah, but now they're having cognitive gains and social gains and they're making eye contact. It's actually speaking to the autism. And if we want to understand what autism is, we have to start looking at it as, I believe, a medical condition. Why are they making improvements on medical cannabis? Something's going on there. But like Amanda said, we're having trouble getting past these federal blocks to research and whatnot. The kids, you know, there's a kid, I'll call him Max, in Texas. He's 19 now. And his mother has a story about they were in a parking lot at like a Walgreens, and Max was trying to bash his head through a windshield. And she's trying to hold him back, and it looked like she was hurting him. You know, and I mean, to go through something like that and people staring and watching, and this is a mother who would spend 70% of her day locked in her room for fear of her child. And people want to say, well, just lock him up. That's her child. She doesn't want to lock him up. She wants some answers. She wants some help. Max is on a THC and a CBD patch transdermally that she gets out of Colorado illegally. And now this mother's a felon. Thank you very little. Because she's trying to help her son. She takes a 16th of the patch, and Max wears it. He was also grandma's seizures. His seizures are gone with the CBD. With the THC, she's able to live freely in her home. So the THC is helping the behaviors. The CBD's got the seizures down. This kid would remove his CBD patches. And finally she said, you know, I'm going to give up on that. He had one grand mal seizure and he started putting them back on and not touching them anymore. And he has communicated to her. He said to her, I'm not autistic anymore. Of course he still is, but he's gotten so much better now that he can see it. He can feel it. He knows there's a big difference here. So when I hear stories like that, I become more passionate about this. Kids with Tourette's, the symptoms of that going down, being able to communicate effectively, that's huge for a parent. Kids with cancer, I mean, that's a big one. We hear stories all the time of tumors shrinking and life-saving things with the cancer. The epilepsy, obviously, is a big one. There's a mother in Texas we've been working with, another felon. It galls me because these are just regular people. You know, these are just moms trying to help their kids. But her son, grand mal seizures, we were able to put him in touch with an organization here in California and able to keep him off prescription medication and hasn't had any seizures since he started on the cannabidiol. My own son, I will say that he's on a hemp med. Felicia loves that. I will say that. And it's appalling to me that in Texas, we can't come out and say we legally have, you know, strains that can help my kid and that we're able to titrate and look at the medicine and work with a doctor and the rest of that. Felicia has a number of stories as well, because I know she's been working with a lot of moms.
I have California moms, and a lot of their stories are just really exciting. You had brought up family. So we have one family in particular. The 7-year-old son is on the spectrum. His 4-year-old brother is not. And I got to play with the 4-year-old, and it was just really exciting because he came up to me and he said, my brother's not beating me up anymore. And he was really just really excited that his brother had just gained the, I believe the story was the brother he loves his tablet. And the process to take his tablet from him would usually cause behavioral issues. And because of his cannabis therapies, he's able to just be okay with getting the tablet taken away. And there was one incident in particular when the 4-year-old told me, yeah, my brother, like, he didn't attack me, and I took off running, but he didn't come after me. And it was one of those, like, it was just the cutest thing, because, you know, I have a younger sister, and I just think, gosh, you know, like, this little person is afraid of his brother, and this is helping the dynamic. So there's also some of my favorite stories come from moms when they send me pictures of their children doing things that their children usually didn't do. Just, I don't know, simple things like eating with a fork and deciding to pick it up and deciding not to, or waking up and not having wet their diaper and knowing that they have to go to the bathroom, and that's their first immediate response. And, you know, having moms who have 7-8-year-old children who are saying, thank you, like, you have no idea how this just, the extra 15 minutes I've gotten back. So those are some of the really exciting stories that these moms are seeing such gains with their children that I have the tendency to encourage them to seek out some of the therapies for themselves, just because I've shared space with so many of these moms. And
we all have PTSD.
Oh my God.
All the special needs moms have PTSD.
I mean, we laugh a little bit, but that is kind of the reality. Like, when I went to the event, I was in this gay kid who went through reparative therapy was in the sea of love. Like, that's what you see from these moms in the space when you share with them, is just like this incredible sea of love, but at the same time there's just so much pain. And like, when you get to talk to them and you hear like where this pain comes from, like,
we talked to some, we work with a lot of veterans groups also, and I had this conversation because I, you know, sometimes we feel like we have PTSD, but I don't want to take that away from your experience, what you've been through. You really do have PTSD. And he said, no, you do. You can absolutely say that with confidence, because it's an ongoing, constant trauma that you're living over and over and over and over again on a daily basis. So I don't apologize for that anymore.
And so what are we up against here? So we have anecdotal evidence. Where do we need to go? How do we break through? Are we close to breaking through to something that's going to make things start to open up and work? Or where are we?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, we've come a long way. We've come a huge way, right? And one of the ways we know we've come a long way is because the conversations that are happening at the federal level. That, you know, now where, you know, just a few years ago, there was like three or four legislators that we could count on to have this discussion. And they were the same legislators every time, right? Sam Farr, Dana Rohrabacher from California, always been a huge champion. Barbara Lee, always been a huge champion, of course, because she's a champion on everything. But now we have Rand Paul. You know, we have folks from the other side of the aisle that are suddenly saying, you know what? We really need to think about what we're going to do at the federal level because we have 23 states plus D.C. that now allow for medical cannabis, and that's like over half the country's population is now living in a place that has medical cannabis. So it's not something that the federal government can ignore anymore, and it becomes even more hypocritical for them day by day by day to still say that marijuana has no medical value when over half of their population is living in a state that recognizes its medical value.
Not to mention the patent.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, then there's the fact that the federal government has a patent on cannabidiol as a neuroprotectant for brain inflammation, which is an active ingredient in cannabis. So, you know, they speak out of two sides of their mouth. There was a bill that was introduced a few weeks ago called the CARERS Act. It was introduced with Rand Paul and Cory Booker. So again, you know, whoever thought we'd see the two of them standing up in front holding hands in unity, but there you go. It's the issue that brings people together. So they introduced this bill, and it would recognize the federal level, the medical value of marijuana. It would allow any state to develop their own medical marijuana program, so they wouldn't have to pass legislation first in order to get permission to do that. They could just do it. One of the things it does that's a little bit of controversial is that it moves marijuana to Schedule II. So just very, very quickly, the drug scheduling system is a system that we created in the 1970s to classify how dangerous drugs were. And we basically put them into these different schedules according to whether they had medical value, how likely we thought dependence was on them, and their level of dangerousness. So the drugs in the Schedule I category, which is the most restrictive, are viewed as having no medical value, a high level of dependence, and too dangerous to use even under the care of a physician. Marijuana was put in the Schedule I category as a placeholder, while that they could do more investigation into where it should actually go. So Nixon, who created this whole thing, commissioned the Schaefer Commission to do a report and investigate where should marijuana actually go in this schedule. Well, the Schaefer Commission came back with a report called Marijuana, Signal of Misunderstanding, and what they basically said was marijuana should not be in the schedule, that it's extremely safe to use, that there shouldn't be criminal penalties associated with it. Well, Nixon was very upset about this because he had this whole kind of strategy about the war on drugs and about the war on marijuana and what it was going to get him, so he just ignored this report completely. So needless to say, we know marijuana has medical value. We've had reports that say it does. We have just not had that recognition at the federal level of what these people are saying. So marijuana remains in Schedule I. This really makes it almost impossible to do research on it. Schedule I substances are deemed to have no medical value and be very dangerous. So according to the federal government, why would we ever study them for use for something good? The only way we should ever study them is to prevent people from getting their hands on them or ever using them. And then people say, well, what about other countries? Other countries are more supportive of medical marijuana, right? Why don't they do the research there? Well, the National Institute on Drug Abuse controls over 80% of the world's drug research. Mm-hmm. So they're funding the research that's happening in Austria and Germany and all of these places. So that's that same idea of only looking at the bad things about marijuana pervades research that's happening all over the world. But suffice it to say, things are changing. Colorado just donated $9 million of revenue from their adult use cannabis sales to marijuana research. And Dr. Sue Sisley, formerly from the University of Arizona, now working with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, is leading one of those studies to look at marijuana for post-traumatic stress disorder. So we are starting to see things change slowly but surely. I think right now on the federal level, all we can really hope for is for legislators to actually become more involved in this. And then I think eventually we will start to see some movement on the federal level. But honestly, I know we're going to see more states pass it before we see something happen in Washington.
I agree.
Yeah, so that's perfect. Because can you speak to what's happening in Texas right now?
Absolutely. And I want to acknowledge Amanda. She's been instrumental in helping us in Texas. We didn't know each other until we were on this panel and then realized we were working with a lot of the same people. She helped with, I believe, did you help with the bill in the drafting, or was that just MPP?
No, we help with the bill in the drafting. We've been advising the legislators right. who want to bring the bill up.
Right.
We've been advising them on the drafting.
So we're talking about a Senate and a House bill that's a comprehensive whole plant bill. On the Senate level, it's 1839. I forgot what the number in the House bill. But it's Senator Menendez on the Senate side and Senator Marissa Marquez on the House side. So it's a comprehensive whole plant bill. It's the first time a whole plant bill has been introduced in the Texas legislature. So it is history. It's historical. And Amanda has been advising with that. DPA has been advising with that. So they've been huge. My job, as I see it, is to go in and talk to the legislators and tell our stories, have moms go in. We just had a Moms Lobby Day on Thursday that was, I thought, a huge success. We had mothers there for the first time advocating, telling their stories, coming out saying, we want this for our children. And what we've heard a lot of from the legislators is this is a whole new game now because they've been used to, as they put it, a lot of green shirts and dreadlocks. And, you know, I think they're being a bit blanket statement with those kinds of comments, but to have suburban housewives from evangelical churches who drive minivans and go to the GOP convention and are delegates to the Republican Party on a state level, to have these kinds of constituents now going in to their offices and telling their stories, this is brand new for them. And we're in Texas. So it's huge. And to be invited to My own representative gave me the phone number for his wife and said, you talk to my wife and you get her on board and you've got me. So next day I'm calling his wife and we're having lunch and we're talking about medical cannabis. And she's going, I can't believe I'm talking about medical cannabis. And now you're invited to this Republican women's group. And how about, do you want to talk to these people about it and these people? So the doors are opening and I see my job is to educate and tell our stories and let people get to know us and let people know in these small towns and in these, you know, conservative areas that we're not talking about smoking for nausea and pain anymore. This is an actual medicine that is saving lives and changing the lives of people who are desperate for something to help their children. So where Amanda's, you know, doing the frontline work in terms of drafting legislation and advising, and she's kind of the official story there. We're the people that it actually affects, and our job is to go in and tell our stories and change hearts and minds.
So we're about to move into question and answers with the audience, so get ready with your questions. And before I do that, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin, but I'm going to start as you get ready. I want to ask one question for quick answers, which is fast forward, oh, just a few months from now, everything changes, everything's approved, the lid's off. And at that point, what happens? Kevin, what happens when it all gets removed and all of a sudden cannabis is available for research and study and kids and families?
Is that my question?
No,
that's for our panel, and then
right.
and then we'll turn it over to the audience.
Right.
Okay, so do we want to answer that question first? Amanda,
yes,
what are your thoughts?
Why don't we start with Amanda and work
or Felicia?
So you're saying that if all of a sudden cannabis were just legal and available and there was no restriction on it anymore, and wow.
Right? I know. It's like, I'm sorry, I can't even imagine.
Well, you know, I would say that the work really then starts, mm-hmm. to be honest. You know, we talk a lot about passing laws. But after you pass something, you have to make sure that it works. You have to make sure that it's implemented. So even if tomorrow they were to say, you know what, cannabis, go for it, we would still have to figure out the best way to ensure that the product is safe, that the right people are getting their hands on it, that they have access to the preparations they need, that the people that are growing it are doing so environmentally responsible ways. So, you know, it's almost the easy part is convincing people we need a change. And the hard part is infusing that change in a way that's going to benefit society.
Great, thank you. I'd just like to let our audience listening at home, like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Cannabis Healing Our Kids, A New Paradigm for Recovery. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our panelists tonight are Talia Michelle, Felicia Carbajal, Amanda Ryman, and moderator Christy Dames. Again, our program, Cannabis Healing Our Kids, A New Paradigm for Recovery. And I do want to ask you all of you guys, So can you make it really clear, this is actually healing kids. This is not just healing. This is not just like nausea and symptoms. This is actually healing. Is that right?
I believe so, yes, especially when you look at, first of all, the epilepsy kids and the seizures. Yes, there are kids that are going from 300 seizures a week to 3 to 0. Yes, absolutely. You hear a lot about Charlotte's Web or high CBD for epilepsy. Some of the kids need a little more THC. So when it's opened up a bit and families in states like Texas can actually look at various strains, there's no telling. I don't know how many it could and would help. Maybe not all kids. I don't know. But when it is open, you know, back to Christy's question, my imagining is, oh my gosh, we could research. We could find out why it helps some or not others, or why this strain and not that strain, and what that, there's no telling where this could lead or how it could help. With autism, you know, I know of a mom who has a blog. I know her personally, and she says cannabis use here in California has recovered her children. They no longer have autism diagnosis, and she attributes it to that. I would love some more research on that. What did she do? Why did this happen with these children? There's a young man in Maine said his first words at 24 on a THC strain. It's THCA actually, which is the acidic precursor to THC. So it didn't have the euphoric effect. And this man is saying his first words where his parents never thought they would hear his voice. He is speaking. So do I feel this is healing children? It's doing something, and it looks a lot like healing to me.
Great. Well, we have someone here tonight who is a doctor who is treating children with cannabis, and I would like to ask him to make a statement and tell us a little bit about his practice and some of his success. I'm going to ask him to come up here.
Sure. My name is Frank Lucido. I have a medical practice in Berkeley, California since 1979, family practice, and then since 1996, medical cannabis evaluations. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I've seen probably 60 kids with seizure disorder and or autism, most of them with both. And probably about 40 of them I'm actually actively still seeing. And the CBD seemed to be the best for the seizures. But with the autism, I have some of the parents saying that they did a little bit better when they added some THC, especially when there's behavioral issues, anger, violence. They're able to be calmer, happier, learn better. So healing, yes and no. I mean, the autism may always still be there, but when they can learn better and learn faster, a lot of what we call autism seems to disappear. Most of these kids I've seen only for a couple of years now. So it's been very positive. So I just want to say that about CBD is great, but THC is sometimes the thing to use.
That is exactly what we're hearing from the moms as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Questions?
I'm going to turn it over to our audience members, and then thank you. If you can introduce yourself too.
Yes, thank you. My name is David Goldman. I represent the Browning Mary Democratic Club, and I also work with the Coalition for Cannabis Policy Reform. I want to reiterate what Talia said. I'm in contact with three parents who are in the Apidiolex study. Apidiolex is a natural plant, whole plant extract with CBD only in it, and it's made by GW Pharmaceuticals, and it's being tested. It's in the end of phase two of FDA testing at 300 children at 30 test sites across the country, including University of California, San Francisco, Mission Bay. And three parents contacted me that they weren't having as much success with their children's seizure suppression until they added a little THC to the pure CBD mixture they were taking. So I think it's really important that people understand that it isn't THC bad, CBD good. In fact, it's believed by many scientists that both THC and CBD potentiate each other and they work better together than separately. It's what we call the entourage effect, that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
I've got a question in the back, but could you maybe explain for those of us that aren't familiar the difference between what CBD stands for, what it is, THC, how these things all work?
Felicia?
So CBD is cannabidiol. When we talk about the non-psychoactive parts of the plant, That's what everybody's referencing when we talk about CBD. So the hot topic was, you know, we talk about CBD-only bills. They're trying to eliminate the psychoactive element, which is THC, which I think most people are really familiar with. So with these children in particular, with my experience, a lot of the parents are very conservative, and I actually suggest being conservative as well, just because it ends up being one of those, you know, your kid. You don't want to get them high. That's what a lot of parents who have children on the spectrum come, and they come from that standpoint because that's what they hear. You know, CBD is good, THC is bad, and the majority of families that I've worked with, I've seen just an absolute transition to, that's really working for my kids, not really getting them high. And so all of a sudden, you know, THC is no longer.
And when we think about the pharmaceuticals that are prescribed for epilepsy and autism, I promise you, kids on benzos for epilepsy, those kids are gorked out. They're stoned out of their minds. Those kids can't walk. I've seen them drooling and crawling across the floor. These are seizure medications. With autism, you know, it's Valium, it's Risperdal, it's Ritalin. Ritalin, college kids are buying that on the black market. You know, these are the drugs that they're prescribing for these children, and yet they're worried about the kids getting a little high from THC. And usually when you're adding in THC for epilepsy and autism, the parents are titrating up very slowly. They're looking for that sweet spot where their kid isn't gorked out and can function better. So I think it's just a much better alternative to my mind.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, this is... Everyone's staring at me right now. I'm getting nervous. Anyway, you know that movie called Reefer Madness?
Yes.
And so, and the federal government, and they try to turn this cannabis into some demon or something.
Sure.
And I mean, they have alcohol, they have tobacco, you know, which isn't really healthy. And meanwhile, this THC stuff, you can make your different doses and make your different strains, and it's healthy. I mean, what's going on with the federal government?
Marijuana laws, like most all of our drug laws in this country, it really had nothing to do about the drug or the dangerousness. It had to do with what population was using that substance and how the control we wanted to exert over that population. So, you know, marijuana, for example, was Mexican immigration happening in the early 1900s. African immigration coming in through Louisiana and Texas in the early 1900s. And the desire by the federal government to keep tabs on these folks. So the idea of criminalizing their substance of choice was something we had done before with Chinese immigration and opium in San Francisco. We created an idea around that these drugs made people crazy, but not everybody, just the people we were afraid of. Mm-hmm. And that when these folks were crazy, they would go after usually white women was the imagery that they tried to present.
The new Jim Crow.
And so they really used this imagery to create the idea of Reefer Madness, and it was so successful. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it was so successful is because back then, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine in this day of like immediate news gratification, but back in that day, you had someone on the radio telling you what was going on in the whole country, and you just accepted it. So if you were in, you know, California, and you heard someone on the radio telling you that, a Mexican guy in Texas used marijuana and went and shot up the whole town, you believed it. And you felt that there was a reason why we needed to keep this drug away from people. And it's really not until now that you're seeing the folks that were around during that really height of Reefer Madness, who were young people and teenagers in the 1930s and 40s, are starting to die off, they're starting to retire. And folks that are coming up now, you know, really are looking at the whole Reefer Madness thing with a much more critical eye. But we do see remnants of that. And one of the biggest places we see remnants is the hesitation to approving cannabis for mental health conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when it comes to physical pain, we're like, sure, you know, somebody's got chronic physical pain, they've got nausea, give them cannabis. When we talk about things like autism or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety, there's still that real stigma around giving cannabis to people who have mental health conditions. Even though the research shows that it does not exacerbate these conditions, that's still left over from that Reefer Madness. So that's absolutely something that we're fighting against even today.
Hi, my name is Alice. I'm actually from Treatwell and had a couple questions about dosing. I hear a lot about the dosing with epilepsy, but I'm not really familiar with autism and what the dosing is. I know it depends on how severe it is, I also heard that more THC is better. Are you saying, like, what ratio is CBD to THC, 1-to-1, or what type of ratios? And maybe a little bit more detail.
So parents with children on the spectrum, they like to call everything protocols, so they force us into creating protocols. And these are very, very loose protocols. So it starts anywhere with, depending on if your child has no seizure disorders, so say your child is just on the spectrum, the suggested, like, suggested dose is anywhere from 6 to 12 milligrams per ml, 2 to 3 times a day of CBD. So, like, something 15 to 1 or higher. The titration typically should, well, because these parents are always going to be cautious anyway, it can take anywhere from typically anywhere from 2 to 3 to 4 weeks before any levels of THC are ever entered. And we're talking about 0.1 and just basically, like she said, titrating to find that sweet spot.
All the kids are different. It really is a trial and error thing. And if you had specific questions, I would recommend talking to the doctor here because he probably has more experience with that. But all the kids are different, and it is a trial and error thing. And you have to find what's going to work for that kid. You know, Max, for instance, it's a high CBD patch and a high THC patch at this 16th, and they had to try and they had to figure out what worked for that kid. So I'm with Felicia. I like starting with the higher CBD and then finding where is that sweet spot with that THC just gradually, because nobody wants to see their kid, you know, laying on the couch drooling.
And the theory kind of behind it is just, you know, just get as much CBD into their bodies to just help heal that endocannabinoid system. So CBD is not going to be anything bad, and for the most part, parents who are utilizing at those particular levels are just seeing, like, the basic cognition, which is one of the first steps that parents who have children on the spectrum, they want to see, because it's going to be one of those really big gains.
One of the interesting things is what I hear a lot from parents, and, you know, you and the doctor might or may not have the same experience. I hear that within the first 3 or 4 days, one of the first gains that parents come to me and say is that their kids' digestive systems seem to be doing better. So a lot of these kids have constipation and diarrhea a lot of times. And one of the first things is, oh my gosh, my kid had his first well-formed poop.
Well,
and it's a huge big deal for these kids that, you know, 9 years of fighting these gastrointestinal disorders. I mean, huge for them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense because, you know, our body has cannabinoid receptors, right? And they are one of the highest levels of concentration of cannabinoid receptors is in the gut. And that's one of the reasons why cannabis is such an effective medicine for appetite stimulation, Crohn's disease, colitis, other types of gastrointestinal disorders. We also have concentrations of receptors in our eyes, which is one of the reasons it's so helpful for glaucoma. Also, different parts of the brain, another reason why it's good for mental health symptoms. I mean, you know, our bodies work in symbiotic motion with the plant. The plant detects where our bodies are deficient in their own endocannabinoid production and targets those systems directly. I mean, it's really remarkable.
Great. We have another question over here. I'm going to turn it over now.
Hi, Brian Rosenthal, the Can I Dream Foundation. We're a charity for children's causes, and one of our projects is a Cannabis as Medicine project, because I think a lot of you have been very modest. In my experience with some of the families and children that I've dealt with, it has healed. I can speak specifically, Dolly Barnhart is a kid with brain cancer, diagnosed terminal. Her cancer is shrinking, her tumor is disappearing. She's going to live a long, healthy life. That's healing, as far as I'm concerned. One other thing I want to say, thank you for being here. I'm so grateful that we can have this dialogue. This is really a beginning for what I see and where we're going. But really, my question is, in the meantime, you know, and as we wait for federal to get their act together, for states to get their act together, what can we do to streamline our efforts in the meantime? Right now, something I'm doing is I'm helping families in states where it's illegal, getting them out here, getting them legal recommendations. Dr. Lucido was one that we've worked with and others, and that's great, but it's not the ultimate solution. Another thing we're working on is a home, a center where folks can come to when they're in a state where it's illegal, get cannabis therapy, traditional therapy, healthy living guidance, because as you pointed out, I really believe it is not just cannabis, but a whole living approach to find relief for these seriously and critically ill children. So my question again is, what can we do now?
I'd like to, if I could, Well, the biggest thing, aside from just us coming out, because that's really, really important, and us encouraging other people who benefit from this medicine to come out, we have to also remember, because all of us in this room probably live in California, so we're a little entitled, like myself. And we have to remember that we have to support individuals like Talia, who are fighting every day to get access for families. So those of us who do live this kind of entitled lifestyle where we're in utopia pretty much in California, you know, making some calls, doing just the basics to be able to support efforts in other states.
Come to Texas and talk at a hearing. You could come to Texas and speak at a hearing, or you know,
come to Texas and get the moms to get on board. These moms are scared. Yeah.
Here's the thing. One thing that being in Texas and in this work has taught me is patience. And I want to encourage you to say that you are doing it. We are in the meantime. We are everybody here who is involved in this work. The fact, and if you're not involved in the work, that you have an interest in it, you are the change. And that's what I'm always reminding my moms all the time. Oh, it's impossible. You say the bill is a snowball in El Paso. It can't survive. Yes, but we are the change. This is happening. Texas introduced a whole plant bill. We're discussing autism as a qualifying condition. This is the meantime. We are doing it. And we just keep on and have the discussions, and how can we improve, and how can we do more, and how can we connect, and how can we help, and who else, and we brought in. But this is it. You're in it.
We have time just for about two or three more questions, and these people, I'm going to go in order of who's raised their hands.
Hi, this piggybacks kind of on this gentleman's question as well. I'm here with my mother tonight, who killed a brain tumor using medical cannabis.
Yay.
That's great news. She's very shy. She's probably really embarrassed that I announced that to you guys right now. We are originally from Oklahoma, and so I can really relate to you talking about these mothers who are felons who are just trying to mm-hmm. do the best that they can for their mm-hmm. families.
Yeah.
We made the really difficult and very quick decision to move to California, establish residency, so we could have access to this type of medication for my mother. Since then, we had the good news in December, so we've been working really hard to spread the word, and we've come across a lot of families who say, man, I wish I could.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a financial reason, or there's so many reasons why you can't just pick up and move. So what advice do you have for those families who are in these states, however few they are now, which is great, who are in these states where if they pursue this type of medication, they can be, you know, put in prison or to uproot their families, especially when there's children involved, to move to a place where they can have access to this. What type of advice do you have for the families who are facing this difficult decision?
My advice is to get involved and to start making noise and to start telling your story and to let your legislators know on the federal and the state level. We've got to start making changes there. And I'd love to hear from Amanda. You know, what do you tell families? I'm sure you get this question all the time.
We get this question a lot. And, you know, I wish I had better answers because, you know, you're right. It's very difficult. It's completely illegal to ship CBD, even though it is a non-psychoactive chemical, across state lines. You know, that's not legal to do. And unfortunately, what we're seeing now is a lot of predators out there mm-hmm. that are claiming they have CBD mm-hmm. and they're gonna willing to ship it to you anywhere you are. And this is concerning because they're preying on people that are very desperate to get medicine.
I want to tell a story about a family in Texas.
So I think one of the most important things I would say is for them to really do their homework and their research on what they're trying to get their hands on. And then something else that goes back to what the other gentleman was saying about what you can do. You know, I have this vision, and I know this is already starting to happen, of this like underground railroad system for medical cannabis patients where, you know, there are people that are willing to go and do these runs from, and I'm not advocating for this because it's illegal,
it happens.
And I think that, you know, parents and others that are really trying to get this medicine into the hands of their loved ones, you know, I work with a woman who does oils for people that she creates herself, cannabis oils. And anytime someone calls me from another state, I put them in touch with her. And she had a client from Indiana who called trying to get cannabis oil for his daughter who had cancer. And she said, I will give it to you. He hopped on his motorcycle that day with his friends and drove across country to California to get that oil for his daughter.
I don't know.
And there are a lot of people that are doing that. So anything we can do to help those folks, whether it's financially, whether it's protecting them legally, whether it's giving them a place to stay along the road between Indiana and California. You know, I mean, this is an underground railroad situation. I mean, these are people that need our help in states that don't understand what they're doing by preventing people from access.
I want to tell a quick story about exactly what Amanda's talking about. We have a mom in Texas who thought she was giving her son as CBD oil. She was told it was CBD. She gave him a dropper full, took a dropper full herself. They both were hallucinating, and it was very scary. The kid slept and wouldn't wake up, and she was hallucinating, and she freaked out and called, went to the emergency room, took the kid in there. They tested him, and of course, it was high THC and CPS and the district attorney and right, and she's in Texas. Now, granted, she's in Travis County, which is Austin, so that's one of the more liberal areas, but it's a kid with an illegal substance, and what are they going to – they have to go after this, you know, even if – so that's one example. Another thing that happened to me personally is that I had a family therapist turn us in for using CBD to CPS. So I had CPS knocking on my door because of the work that I do. And I calmly said, yeah, you know, come on in. They talked to the school. They said, oh, Talia's wonderful. She's an advocate. We know she gives her son hemp, and that's fine. And, you know, I laid the hemp product out there, and I said, you know, what? The CPS worker said,
I bought it on Amazon.
Yeah. The CPS worker said, if it had been me, I never would have turned you into this. But it just goes to show the lack of education. As I was talking to this therapist, she got completely confused about what I was talking about. And, you know, it's a lack of education. People don't understand the issue. So just talking about your experience, educating others, I think is a big, big deal.
Thank you. My name is Larry Lum, and up until tonight, I didn't realize the medical component of grass. Hmm. I like grass. I got high and loved it. But anyway, we're talking about getting the Congress, the United States Congress, to realize the medical benefits of this. Mm-hmm. And we have you have an opportunity to get a direct line to the Senate right now. There is a man upstairs, Senator Barry Sanders, he's giving the presentation. And I think he's one of the more reasonable senators we have in this country.
Thank you.
You're absolutely correct. And I have to say, this is one of those issues where the far left and the far right shake hands behind your back and agree on this. Because
it's true.
The libertarians feel that people should have access to put in their bodies what they want. And the liberals think that we should have access to this alternative medicine and that we should be able to have this kind of choice. And they really agree on this issue. So, I mean, that's where Rand Paul and Cory Booker.
I'll tell you, in the Texas the legislators in Texas, I have had them tell me, oh, you know, we're for this, we want to support you, but I can't because I will lose not the election. They're not afraid of the election because they'll beat a Democrat, no problem. They're afraid of the primary because if I, as a conservative Tea Partier, come out in favor even of a CBD bill, the next conservative Tea Partier running against me in a primary just needs to send out a flyer that says he voted for marijuana. That's it, because it's a conservative state. So it's not that they're afraid of losing an election. They're afraid of losing a primary. But it is fear. And my Bible says perfect love driveth out fear. And I feel like that plant is just full of love. And I know I have love for my children. I know the moms have love for their children. I know you guys, the ones that it's all love. And it's working.
Good. Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program now where we have time for only one more question, and then I'm going to turn it back over to Christy to ask our panelists to wrap up. So I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is Cannabis Healing Our Kids, A New Paradigm for Recovery with Talia Michelle, Felicia Carbajal, Amanda Ryman, and moderator Christy Dames. So we will have one more question and then turn it back over to Christy to close the program with each panelist to wrap up.
So I'm a private medical cannabis consultant. I do in-house consultations and caregiver education. A lot of my patients are adults, and they've come to me saying that CBD hasn't been working for them. CBD alone hasn't been working for them, and we know that a little bit of THC is necessary for the CBD to be effective. Are you at all concerned that the legislation in these states that are requiring CBD-only bills will derail the medical cannabis movement because they'll say this isn't effective, we're seeing it's not effective? That's my concern. I'm wondering if you share.
I think this is a really good point. And, you know, we mentioned the 23 medical cannabis states plus D.C. There's a good six or seven others that have CBD-only bills.
11.
We just don't count them. 11. We just don't count them. We count only the ones that have comprehensive bills being an actual medical marijuana state. I think that the CBD only is safe for people because, again, it's the psychoactivity. It's like the lack of euphoria. But because there isn't any psychoactivity, it's harder to tell sometimes what the symptom relief is with CBD. It may take a little bit longer than with THC where you're actually feeling the psychoactive effect. So, you know, I'll just tell you kind of at my organization, Drug Policy Alliance, how we view the CBD versus the comprehensive bills. Because, you know, we have been asked to support CBD-only bills, and we have supported CBD-only bills. What we look at is we look at the state, and we say, does this state have a chance to pass something that's comprehensive? Like, is this something we could possibly see? Or is this something, like in a state like Georgia, where it's probably not going to happen for quite some time, and CBD-only may be the only chance we have right now for anybody to get access to cannabis in that state. But then we look at a state like Texas, where they have introduced a comprehensive bill, and a state like Florida, where they were voting a comprehensive bill, and in those states, there is no room for CBD-only. Because in those states, we have a chance to pass comprehensive bills, and that's what we should be passing. So I see CBD only as an intermediary step for states that are just so far behind that it's just going to be so long before they come on board. But it is absolutely not a stopping point. You know, at the very least, it's a way to get your foot in the door. But it really should be just a step on the way to something more comprehensive, always.
Well, I don't see the CBDs as blocker bills. I've heard people say that. Well, they're just putting it there to block. I don't believe that. I do believe that most of the legislators are trying to do something, even in these really conservative states. I have to believe that. I have to have faith. I also do have faith that there will be a change nationwide, and it will be in our lifetime. So, again, patience. It is happening. This is the meantime.
Christy, would you like to wrap it up?
Yes. I'd like to know if you were to tweet out your call to action and to who that might be. Maybe it's to a mom or a child of someone who's recovered. If you were to tweet out your call to action to the most specific person, institution, group, whoever, what would that tweet be and who would it be to? What would you say to them? Amanda, let's start with you.
Oh, goodness, I have so many. I would ask Obama why he's the member of the Choom Gang that still won't legalize marijuana. No, I mean, honestly, it wouldn't really be to a specific person because I feel like the best thing we can do is to have as many cannabis-positive conversations with as many people in our lives as possible. Mm-hmm. And whether that's the person next to you in the grocery store, whether that's the person next to you on the plane, or whether that's your mother or brother or father or sister, the more people we have out there saying, look, cannabis is a medicine, I believe that, I know other people that believe that, the more the faster the stigma goes away. I mean, that's just how it goes. So all of you out there, go home today or tomorrow and have at least one cannabis-positive conversation with somebody that you've not talked about this with yet. And you'll really be surprised. I mean, it's like you'll say, you know, I think cannabis is a good medicine. It's like, oh, my God, so do I. And you'll be surprised how many people are out there right now feeling the same way. You just have to start that conversation.
Felicia.
Well, being that I'm the change hearts and minds, I think I would just, my tweet would be simple. Come out wherever you are. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah. Tell you.
I have two. My first one would be to Amy Lou Faywell, and it would just be, we are doing it. It's the impossible. Autism is a qualifying condition. And my other would be to autism moms specifically across the nation and the world, contact your legislators, share your stories.
Beautiful. Christy, closing comments from you?
I think these are the times of strange bedfellows where you, the far left and right, meet the back. Mm-hmm. And there are alliances and collaborations that are happening everywhere, and it's the most powerful positive shift I can see. To someone that may have been considered an enemy, that now they are on your team, is an amazing thing. It drops a lot of resentment, forms collaborations that I'm seeing everywhere. And so that would be my tweet.
Okay, well, I'd like to. Our program tonight has been Cannabis Healing Our Kids, A New Paradigm for Recovery. Our panelists have been Talia Michelle, Felicia Carbajal, Amanda Ryman, and Christy Dames. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I've been your host for tonight. And with this, I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club tonight, thank our audience listening at home. And with this, I close our program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. Thank you all for coming.